Okay, tonight, chapters 34 and 5. I'm glad there's a chapter break, but there really isn't a. It's like the before and after, or the negative and the positive, the flip side. Chapter 34 paints a really dire picture. Chapter 35 paints a beautiful picture, and but it's the picture that takes place at the same time, depending upon which side of the coin you're on, as it were. I've got to say that I have been overwhelmed by this study, but I've also been richly blessed by it. I'm seeing the book of Isaiah coming into focus more and more. It seems like every time I study through it, that happens. But seeing the extended picture that Isaiah is painting, it started with God's case against Judah in chapter 2. He laid out all 2 and 3, all manner of things that he was opposed to. But in chapter 4, he would have in the last days, he would raise up a branch and rescue the remnant. And so that kind of been the proposition throughout, but it's expanded to include impact upon the surrounding nations. You might recall that section where say beginning in chapter end of chapter 14, where all the various nations who were in dread of the Assyrian invasion were counseled at the various places not to put their hope. But if you want to survive the storm, go to Zion. And so we're going to close out today with this idea of the glorious Zion, what it's going to look like when God finishes his plan. And so it's really exciting. Now, chapters 36, 7, 8, and 9 is the historical record of when Assyria tried to invade Judah. In fact, it captured all but one of the fortified or the walled cities. And the water, it says, came up to the neck in chapter 8. But Sennacherib, as you know, his armies were destroyed by the angel of death. And he fled back to his homeland after 185,000 of his soldiers died. Well, that's what 36, 7, and 8, or 36, 7, 8, 9 talk about, that event. And that's like that brings to an end the threat that we saw beginning in chapter 7, where Assyria was invited into the land. Assyria was destroyed in the land by God. But as we'll see in chapter 38, 39, Hezekiah got a little excited about the victory and started showing all of his treasures to the ambassadors from Babylon. And God says, you know what? All those things are going to Babylon in about 100 years. And so, whereas 36, 7, 8, and 9 kind of bring to a close the Assyrian aspect of this, it introduces the Babylonian aspect of it in spades, as it were. But this tonight will just kind of bring us up to that piece of closure. Let me just start reading at verse 1. Draw near, O nations, chapter 34, verse 1. Draw near, O nations, to hear and listen, O peoples. Let the earth and all it contains hear, and the world and all that springs from it. For Yahweh's indignation is against all the nations, and wrath against all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to slaughter. So their slain will be thrown out. Now, I want to stop reading right there. And how much of that in verse 2, how much of that was factually true at the time? His indignation against the nation, that's true. But it says, he has, notice the past tense, he has utterly destroyed them. Now, granted, once it has been spoken by God, it's a fact. It just hasn't happened yet. But he's speaking of a future when Zion would be established. Of course, that was the days of Jesus and his apostles, in which these things actually took place. And so we're going to find a fulfillment of these things. Look over in Revelation chapter 19. Now, what do you know about Revelation 19, just off the top of your head? Anything outstanding about Revelation 19?
It's after 18.
After 19. Look at verse 7. The marriage of the Lamb has come. But in verse 11, he saw heaven open and he saw this warrior, Christ, on a white horse with the blood of nations spattered all over his robe. Okay. In verse 13, clothed with a white robe, dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God, and the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses. Out of his mouth came a sharp sword, with which he may smite the nations. Isaiah 34, 2, Yahweh's indignation is against the nations. Here in 19, at the time of the marriage of the Lamb. Now we saw the marriage feast back in chapter 25. We saw it there. Here of Isaiah. But here, his wrath is against all the armies. He has utterly destroyed them and given them over to slaughter. And we read of the picture that was, what is it that John said about the book of Revelation, both at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book? Pardon? I'm coming quickly. It must shortly take place. And various time statements at the beginning and the end of the book of Revelation tell us that it was expected to happen in the generation that John lived in. There's nothing in the book of Revelation that projects beyond that. It's God summing up his plan there with the destruction of Jerusalem. And so I'm tying Isaiah 34 to Revelation 19, or maybe I should say it the other way around. Isaiah 34 is predicting the thoughts in Revelation 19, but I want to keep reading in 19. Where is it that I wanted to read? Verses 17 and 18. I saw an angel standing in the sun. He cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid heaven, come, assemble for the great supper of God, in order that you may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of commanders, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all men, both free men and slaves, and small and great. And look what we have here in Isaiah 34. And it says in verse 3, so they're slain, and they're, in verse 2, they're given over to great slaughter. Their slain will be thrown out, their corpses will give off their stench, the mountains will be drenched with their blood, and all the hosts of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. But you have this slaughter that is just doesn't say in Isaiah 34 about the birds and the beast feasting on the dead body, but it talks about the same set of dead bodies. Okay? So the slain will be thrown out. Now look at verse 4. And all the hosts of heaven will wear away, and the sky will be rolled up like a scroll, and all their host also will wither away, as a leaf withers from the vine, or one withers from the fig tree. For my sword is satiated in heaven, and it shall descend for judgment upon Edom and upon the people whom I have devoted for destruction. We'll stop reading there. Come back and talk about Edom in a minute, but I want to pick up here in verse 4. And the sky will be rolled up like a scroll. Have you seen that image before? Like Sunday morning? Book of Hebrews, chapter 1. Hebrews 1, verses 10 through 12. As the Hebrews writer HW, I call him, Hebrews writer, is talking about how much greater the message is that we have. God used to speak in a variety of ways, but now in these last days has spoken to us through his son. Jesus is better than the angels in a variety of ways. Angels chapter 2 gave us the law of Moses, but Jesus gave us the Messiah's covenant. But as he's talking about the change from one covenantal system to the next, heaven and earth, this is a secret that I don't keep secret. Heaven and earth, as it's used in Matthew 24, as it's used in Isaiah, as it's used in 2 Peter, and in the book of Revelation, the new heavens and the new earth, is not talking about the physical territory. The old heavens and earth were the covenantal system of Moses. In fact, Josephus, if you recall, at least twice in his works, said, we Jews called the temple heaven and earth because that's where God and man met, the heaven and earth. And so when it says here in Hebrews 1, the heavens are the works of your hand, they will perish, but you remain, and all will become old like a garment, and like a mantle you will roll them up, and like a garment they will also be changed. Every once in a while, and I suppose Linda wishes it were more often than once in a while, I'll take off a dirty pair of trousers, roll them up, throw them in the laundry, and put on a new pair. They change. So that's what's going to happen to the heavens and earth. Is it going to change? Okay. Now, this is from the book of Proverbs. No, I'm sorry. That looks like Proverbs. Psalms, because there are not 102 chapters in Proverbs. It's a book of Psalms 102. Now, I'll pick up a little bit of the context of this also. Now, of course, the Psalms had been written by the time of Isaiah, hadn't they?
I'm sorry, what chapter again, Rod?
I'm going to 102 if I can get the pages apart. Okay. Psalm 102, and I'm going to start in verse 25. Of old you founded the earth, and the heavens are the works of your hand. Even they will perish, but you endure. And all of them will wear out like a garment, like clothing, you will change them, and they will be changed. Now, he's not talking about the physical universe, the earth upon which we live. He's talking about something that he would change that people would still be on. You are the same, and your years will not come to an end. The children of your servants will continue, and their descendants will be established before you. Now, this is a passage that's quoted in Hebrews, but it's also the passage alluded to here in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 34. But now watch this over here in Isaiah 51. I'm trying not to go too fast so you can write these things down. So we have, first of all, Hebrews 1, 10 through 12, which was a quotation from Psalm 102, 26, and I read 25 through 28. But I want you to look also here at Isaiah 51. In Isaiah 51, beginning at verse 14, well, verse 12, he says, I am the one who comforts you. Down in verse 14, he says, the exile will soon be set free and will not die in the dungeon, nor will his bread be lacking. For I am Yahweh, your God, who stirs up the sea and its waves roar. Now, what do you know about the sea?
The Gentiles, the sea of humanity.
That's the sea of humanity. Well said, Michael, the sea of humanity. Out of which, if you are familiar with Daniel, beast after beast after beast after beast came up out of the sea. And there's a lot of references you can look to see that this is a reference to just mankind in general. Okay, you stir up the sea, and the waves roar. Yahweh of hosts is his name. and I have put my words in your mouth. Now, I don't know if he's talking here to Isaiah specifically, or if he's talking to the servant that he's talking about in the book of Isaiah, or if he's talking to the nation of the faithful remnant. I have put my word in your mouth and covered you with the shadow of my hand to establish the heavens and to found the earth and to say to Zion, you are my people. So from that, what can you adduce that the heavens and earth are a reference to? Is he making four different things here? The heavens, the earth, Zion, and his people? Or is he talking about one and the same thing? I propose that he's talking about the new creation, that we are a new creation. He's talking about the new creation, the new heavens and the new earth, which is, I saw the new heavens and new earth coming down out of heaven, which is what? The bride of Christ. The bride, yeah, the bride, the new heavens, the new earth, the church, it's all one and the same, just different references. So we're going to roll up the old one, get rid of it, change it, and we're going to have the new one, the new heavens and the new earth. Okay, so that's what Isaiah's hinting at. Now, hinting at, that's what he's talking about in language that you and I can put together and grasp, but they wouldn't have a concept of that, other than this is where we live with God, this heaven and earth. So I'm going to, the old one is going to roll up like a scroll. All the hosts wither away, back in Isaiah 34, 4, as a leaf withers. And then verse 5, my sword is satiated in heaven. What is that? Satiated. Say, she-ated. She-ated?
Like when you eat enough.
When you eat enough. Yeah. Yeah, it means to be, to have enough, to be completely filled.
My version says my sword has drunk its fill in heaven.
Okay. You probably were reading the same version. No.
No, that was the NIV, and this one's NASB.
Oh, the 2020. Okay. I've got the 1995.
Yeah.
I got the 95. You got, yours is 25 years newer than mine. Okay.
I'm a young buck.
Yeah, you are. And so my sword is satiated, has drunk its fill in heaven. Behold, it will descend for judgment upon Edom. Now, what is Edom? What I'm doing to this cookie? What is Edom? Esau. What did he see?
He saw this and he saw that.
He saw a bowl of lentils and said, I want it. And no, I'm serious. I'm serious about that piece. And so in Hebrews chapter 12, Hebrews chapter 12, HW says, well, I don't want there to be any profane person. Let me start reading in verse 15. See to it that no one comes short of the grace of God. That no root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by it may many be defiled, that no fornicator or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. He didn't value the things of God. Okay? So Esau is put for the godless profane people that we read in verse 1 and 2, verse 2 especially, against all the nations. So why single out Edom? If God's vengeance is against all the nations, why single out Edom?
Because he's kind of close to his story. And if I didn't, he is Isaac's son, right?
Jacob and Esau, come from Isaac.
So he's part of the family.
He's part of the family.
I'm going to do this for part of the family.
Well, I think it's the, yeah. I get your point. I take it well. But he is the epitome of a profane person who doesn't value the things of God. Okay. In Malachi 1, verses 2 through 5, God says, how did he say that? Malachi chapter 1, there's Matthew, Mark, going backwards. There's Malachi. Chapter 1, verses, beginning at verse 2. I said 4, it's 2, my 2. Anyway, I have loved you, says Yahweh. But you say, how have you loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, because Yahweh? Yet I have loved Jacob, but I have hated Esau. I loved Jacob, hated Esau. Because of the kind of person Esau became, he became like the epitome of everything God was opposed to. And you can finish reading that Malachi 1, 2 through 5 passage. Behold, God's sword now will descend. Let me back up and see if I can tie this up, because I've got a lot of loose pieces floating around. That we're closing this story down of the darkness is coming and the threats that coming and the discipline and the being carried off into captivity and all that. And he's saying, now, why would he be opposed to all the nations? Because of their godlessness and because of the way they treated his son. And so we have God saying, I'm going to take care of this problem once and for all. This problem that back in chapter 7, you tried to hire Assyria to take care of for you, and that just exploded on you, kind of metastasized in your face. I'm going to take care of the problem. I'm going to have a sword, and it's going to be satiated with the blood of my enemies. And that's what he's talking about here. I'm wrapping this thing up. I'll take care of your problem. And then chapter 35, look at the blessings I have in store for you. So it's kind of like the end piece of all these promises. When we get to chapter 40, God will look at the same situation from a different angle. He's going to be looking at the loyalty to him as opposed to fearing the idols. Here he's dealing with the garbage in the nation. I have a sacrifice in Bozra. Bozra is one of the chief cities, the chief city of Edom, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen also shall fall with them, young bulls, strong ones, probably not talking about the cattle in the field, but talking about the leaders. Oftentimes, the oxen, the bulls, like in, what was it, Psalm, is it Psalm 18 or 22? My God, why have you forsaken me? I think it's 22. And he talks about how he is surrounded by the wild, the oxen, the mighty, mighty people. Okay. So anyway, watch what it says here. Verse 8, because Yahweh has a day of vengeance. This is my day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. So this is when it all comes to a head. This is when God steps in and rolls up that old covenant, establishes the new covenant, deals with the enemies, sets Israel free, the new Israel, sets her free from pagan homage. From there on out. And so a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. That reminds me of Deuteronomy 32. I'm going to go back there for a bit. And Deuteronomy 32, I look at it as, and I've said this before, it's kind of like the linchpin of the Bible. It's God's plan in a nutshell, from the time that he brought Israel into the land to the time that he took them off the land and brought in Messiah. It's all right there. In verse 35, vengeance is mine and retribution. Earlier he said that they're not my sons. They're not my son because of their wickedness. So I'm going to deal with them. Vengeance is mine and retribution. In due time, their foot will slip, for the day of their calamity is near, and the impending things are hastening upon them. For the Yahweh will vindicate his people. So here's vengeance and vindication. Vengeance and vindication. Yahweh will vindicate his people, 36, and have compassion on his servants when he sees that their strength is gone and they can't do anything about it. We've seen those things in Isaiah that we couldn't deliver ourselves. Okay, now drop down to verse 41 beginning. If I sharpen my flashing sword, did we see a sword in Isaiah 34? Yeah. If I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries and I will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captive from long-haired leaders of the enemy. Rejoice, O nations, his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants. Perk up your ears. Do you know when that God would avenge the blood of his servants? When would God avenge the blood of his servants? If you've read Matthew 23, you know it would be when he tore the temple down. When God destroyed the temple by the Roman Empire. Okay? So here, Deuteronomy 32, verse 43, rejoice, O nations, his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants. He will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land, his people, i.e. his people are his land. We're not looking for some physical terra firma territory for the people of God. His people are his land. Okay, so.
Rod.
Yes, Michael.
I was just going to say this brings to really into insight of Isaiah 46:10, where he talks about he knows the end from the beginning.
Yeah, and we're going to get there, but you're right. And that's the proof, the value and proof of prophecy. The value is it can assure us about the future. Now, what is faith? The assurance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. How can you know that it's going to happen? Because you believe God, okay? Because he can see the end from the beginning. Because we, in another place in the 40s in Isaiah, causing the omens of the boasters to fail by confirming the word of his prophet. God is actively involved in that working of history to make sure that the false ones don't come true and the true ones do come true. And we're going to see that here again in a minute. Okay. So a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. Do you see that there in verse 8? That's what we're talking about. When the cause of Zion is recompense is, and that's what we're reading in Deuteronomy 32. And Jesus, as you saw in Matthew 23, brought Deuteronomy 32's prediction right to that point in time. Okay. And it's, this one's interesting. Verse 9, and its streams shall be turned into pitch. Yeah. You think he's talking literally here? Its streams will be turned into pitch? Now, was it true or not that there was was it in Ohio that there was a river that was actually on fire?
Yeah, Cincinnati.
Cincinnati. Because of what? Because of what? Pollution. Yeah, okay. That's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about people in Bosworth are going to pollute their river and it's going to look like, because it's pitch. Turn to pitch and its loose earth into brimstone, and the land shall become burning pitch. It shall not be quenched night or day. Its smoke will go up forever. Have you ever seen any Google images of Basra? You can go Google Earth. You can see where Basra was today, and there is no smoke ascending into the sky. But this one says, the smoke will go up forever. So who's right? Google Earth or God? Maybe the problem is we're trying to make it literal.
Yeah.
Rather than what is it saying? I'm going to burn this people up and they're not going to be a people anymore. But see, the interesting thing is says it shall not be quenched. What does that mean? Does that mean it's going to burn forever if it's not quenched?
That would burn until there's no more fuel.
Yeah, it's not, nobody is going to put it out. But that doesn't mean it won't go out. It's just there's not going to be any respite. Sometimes the prophets will talk about what is it? A firebrand. You know what a firebrand is? What's a firebrand?
It
has nothing to do with the branding iron.
No, a knot. It's like a knot of brass. That it's no firebrand is exploding. Like when fire pops, right?
No, the firebrand is the unburned stick that's got burn on it. The part of the you've all seen a campfire that it burns out and there's some stubs of sticks around. And sometimes the prophet talks about, I'm going to snatch you from the fire. That's been quenched. Like, this one's not going to be quenched. I'm going to let it burn till it's done. Doesn't mean it's going to burn forever. Doesn't mean it's going to be, burn eternally. And when we talk, for example, of Matthew 3 at verse 12, that I will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire, doesn't mean that chaff is burning, 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 and still burning now, 2,000 years later. That unquenched does not demand it burns forever. Just the only thing it's saying is nobody's going to put it out. Nobody's going to come to your rescue.
No one there to put it out.
Yeah. Nobody will rescue you from me. It's going to, yeah, Linda.
Well, that word forever, we know from Jonah means until it's over.
Yeah. Yeah, Jonah was there. How long was Jonah? Jonah 2:6. How long was Jonah at the bottom of the sea? According to Jonah in Jonah 2:6.
Forever.
Forever. How long was it? 3 days. The word means as long as God intends it to last, until it gets the job done. All right, pushing on. In Revelation 14, at verse 11, we read this. I got the two passages from Revelation that I want to show, because it's easy in the figurative language of the book of Revelation, or as John said at the beginning of the book, it was symbolized, the symbolic language. These are symbols, symbols. And so numbers are symbols and images are symbols and composite symbol images. We're not looking for some grotesque beast. We're looking for what each of those symbols represent about the beast. Enough about that. But it's easy in the book of Revelation to take things and try to force them to be literal rather than get the concept that God is trying to convey. Here, Revelation 14, 11, and the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. Oh, so we get thinking that people are going to be in hell forever and ever, age without end, in a torment of smoke at the hands of a just and loving God. But the problem is that this doesn't mean what we Westerners impute it to mean. They have no rest day and night. Those who worship the beast and his image, whoever received the mark of his name. Just understand that this concept of burning forever means just to burn out and never have a reprieve, never be brought back to a whole or healthy state of mind or state of existence. In chapter 19, what we talked about just a minute ago, the wedding of the bride and the conquering of the Messiah, to make that possible, we have then in verse 20, the beast was seized. The beast is the Roman Empire. And with him, the false prophet. The false prophet is the Jewish hierarchy, the Jewish false religious system, who performed signs in his presence by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worship his image. And these two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone. So we've got that same picture of annihilation or incineration, if you will. Burned up and gone is the key idea of not being extinguished. The opposite of quenched, or the other way of saying quenched, is extinguished. Put the fire out. Not going to happen. This, they're going to go full term on this. On this punishment for me, God is saying here. Okay, now look at 11. back in chapter 34, Isaiah 34, verse 11. Pelican, hedgehog shall possess it. Owl, raven dwell in it. They stretch over it the line, over the line of desolation. Now, the idea of stretching over the line is to survey it, mark out who gets what. That's the idea. And the plumb line of emptiness. So as we figure out and rebuild, it's going to be desolate and empty. That's the way you need to read that. It's nobles. There's no one that, there they could maybe claim the king. And all its princes shall be nothing. And thorns shall come up. What's the picture you're getting of Edom at the time that God, verse 6, he shall descend, or verse 5, descend for judgment upon Edom? What's the picture you're getting as we read these verses?
Wilderness.
Wiped out. No longer a nation. No longer a threat to his people. No longer there to gloat at them or taunt them. You can read the book of, I think it's Obadiah, where he talks about how upset he was with Edom.
Seems like going into a ghost town.
Yeah.
City turned into a ghost.
Yeah, going into a ghost town after the explosion. Wiped out. Okay. Desert creatures, verse 14, meet with the wolves, hairy goat. No people. And this is not going to be a populated. It's going to be wild beast. Now watch this. Verse 16. Seek from the book of Yahweh and read. What are we going to read? We look into God's book and read. Because not one of these will be missing. Everything I said is going to come to pass. Everything I predicted will come true. I've got it written down. You remember what we said earlier? And then we also referenced chapter 44, verses 6 through 8. You are my witnesses. You heard what I said to you. You've got a written testimony of what I've said to you. You're my witnesses. So that when these things come to pass, you can testify that this God, and in fact, let's go to chapter 44 of Isaiah one more time, and we'll get there when we get there. But this point really connects to this end material of chapter 34. In 44, verse 6, thus says Yahweh, the King of Israel and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts, I am the first, I am the last. Now, he's not just talking about his existence. He's talking about in the realm of so-called national deities, I am the first, I am the last. In fact, I'm the only one there is. There is no God beside me. And who is like me? Hey, out there, who's like me? Let him proclaim and declare it. Yes, let him recount it to me in order. You tell me what's going to happen. You tell me what you predicted before that has already happened. Let's get out the ledger sheet here. Let's get out the record of what you said and see if we can find in history that what you said in the past actually comes true. Or let's see if you can say something now that will come true in the future. Let's see what you are, okay? From the time that I established the ancient nation and let them declare to them the things that are coming and the events that are going to take place. That's what I just described to you. Don't tremble. Don't be afraid. A powerful king of a powerful empire caused the people to tremble because he obviously has a greater God than we do. That's the mindset. Okay? Don't be afraid. Have I not long ago announced it to you and declared it? And you are my witnesses. Is there any God beside me? Or is there any other rock? I know of none. Now, when we come back here to Isaiah 34, when he said in verse 16, seek from the book and read, none of these will be missing. When we can see that God predicted, and then we see it comes to pass, see, that's the only God I want to deal with. A God who can tell what the future is going to be and makes it happen. I wanted to look also at chapter 45. Verse 20 and 21. He says, gather yourselves and come. We're having this trial. We're having this It's not the trial. What is it? Where the deposition? We're having this deposition. We're taking testimony from the various gods. Okay, gather yourself and come. Draw near together, you fugitives of the nations. They have no knowledge, who carry about their wooden idol and pray to a god who cannot save. Declare and set forth your case. Indeed, let them consult together. Who has announced this from old? Who has long since declared it? Is it not I, Yahweh? And there is no other God besides me, a righteous God and a Savior. There is none except me. And I can hardly wait to get to those chapters when we can flesh it out in detail. But I wanted you to see the connection between chapter 34, 16 and 17 to the theme. You want to know who God is? Let's, and which God to fear, which God can really save. Let's see who makes predictions that come true. Yeah, Linda, what was your question?
I think it's read verse 9 of 44.
Yeah, I read in 44, I read 6 through 8, I think, maybe 9. In 45, I read 20 and 21, or reference them. But let's get back then to finishing this chapter. It says, none will lack its mate. Look at that. None will lack. Everything I said is going to have its corresponding fulfillment. I think that's what none will lack its mate imply. Okay. For his mouth has commanded and his spirit has gathered it. Please, please take accurate note of that. When God made a prediction, that his mouth commanded it, his Holy Spirit made sure it came to pass. His Holy Spirit, his spirit gathered them, and he has cast a lot for them, and his hand is divided to them by line. They shall possess it forever. God said, these animals are going to get this. All right. Chapter 35, beautiful chapter in contrast to the ugliness of chapter 34, even though 34 did kind of end with, wow, that's God at work. The wilderness and the desert will be glad. And the Arabah will rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It will blossom profusely and rejoice with rejoicing and shout of joy. And the glory of Lebanon will be given to it. What's the glory of Lebanon? The cedar and the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. That was a fruitful plain along the west coast of Palestine. Going to be given to what? The desert and the Arabah. What's the Arabah?
Land by the sea.
It's the Arabah. Generally speaking, it was the area directly below the Dead Sea. The Negev was the southern desert. The Arabah was that. What if the Jordan River had extended, right? But it couldn't because it was still very arid desert. That's the place where the fiery serpents was. They're going to be like Lebanon, and like you see the picture in the book of Ezekiel. We have the a stream trickling from the temple that ultimately got bigger and bigger and bigger until it emptied into the Dead Sea and made it a fishing industry. The picture of God watering the death. What's the desert? Where did John the Baptist come preaching? In the desert. Well, that was literally out in a deserted area, but it was also in barren hearts. But you take the literal and you take the figurative application of it. So that's going to bloom. There's coming a time. And he's not so really concerned about the territory, the terra firma, as he is about the people. And even the barren hearts would blossom and bloom. Ezekiel talked about taking out the heart of stone and replacing it with a heart of flesh. Okay? And so I think that's the picture he's trying to develop here. They will see the glory of Yahweh, the majesty of our God. Encourage the exhausted and strengthen the feeble. Say to those with anxious heart, take courage. Now, you and I can just look at that kind of generically, but what would these people who received the book, how would they be looking at it? What would be causing them anxiety or trembling heart? Would it not be the Assyrian army coming down their stovepipes? You know, it's not like Santa Claus. It would be frightening to them. And so they tell them, take courage, don't fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, and he will save you. That's Deuteronomy 32 again, the passage we just looked at. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Remember what Jesus said? He who has ears to hear, let him hear. He who has eyes to see, let him see. That's this right here. Jesus saying it's time for Isaiah to come true in your life. Okay? Then the lame will leap like a deer, leaping and jumping and praising God. Acts. Is it three? I think it's three. Yeah. I think it's three. Where the healing of the lame at. Okay. There's a song about that, I think. And the tongue of the dumb shall shout for joy, for waters will break forth in the wilderness and streams in the Arabah. So that's the place that was going to blossom and bloom. See, up in verse 1, the wilderness and the Arabah, dry. But they're going to be watered, right? Let me read something we've already looked at. 32:15. Until the Spirit is poured out upon us from on high, and the wilderness become a fertile field, and the fertile field is considered a forest. God would water the wilderness with his Spirit. See? He's not talking about a wilderness of rock and dirt. He's talking about the counterpart of what was like. Didn't Paul in Romans 7 talk about, I think it's 7, about not bearing fruit except for death until you're watered by the Spirit of God? That's the picture he's painting here of what's coming for them. Verse 7, and the scorched land will become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals, its resting place, grass, reeds, and rushes. So we're looking at a place that they knew as barren waste. Perhaps the best way for us to get a picture of it is to think about the Badlands. Now, where are they? The Badlands. Yeah. We've been driven through them. It's just, yeah. But that's not the only place. So what happened with the Columbia River Project? We talked about this last week. All that territory around Moses Lake, which was just shrub, had become big, lush, growing places. Now, peaches from the North Slope, or Royal Slope, are wonderful. Okay, so it would become lush and blossoming and growing. And he's talking about how a people could bear the fruit of the Spirit, for example. All right. What kind of fruit was he looking for in chapter 5? Good grapes were what? Justice and righteousness. Yeah, that's what he's looking for. My people are going to be able to bear that fruit now. You see how he's coming from the problem to the solution in this. And we're summing up the solution here in these two chapters. He says, in verse 8, and a highway will be there, a roadway. What's a highway for? Travel. Have we seen a highway already? You know, when I ask that question, I'm expecting you to say yes, don't you? You're just hesitating to say yes because you don't quite remember where it was. I'm going to 19, verse 23. In that day, there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, And the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egyptians into Assyria. This is not an invasion. This is coming together to worship God. And the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. In that day, Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth. And so the picture is, where was Assyria relative to Israel? Where was Egypt relative to Israel? Egypt was southwest and Assyria was northeast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so with Jerusalem right there in the middle, there would be this highway for people to worship together. That's the picture that he's building, right? And we're not there yet. We'll get there. But in chapter 40, what was the voice in the wilderness doing? Preparing the way of the Lord, making that highway, right? He was there making that highway. Okay. In chapter 2, verse 3, in the last days of the mountain of the house of the Lord be lifted up. Verse 3, many people will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh. They had to have a way to get there. What did Jesus say about himself? I am the way. Okay. Here, we've got this highway that will be a roadway, and it will be called the highway of holiness. The unclean won't travel on ahead, but it will be for him who walks, and fools will not wander on it. How does that read in yours, Rach? Verse 8, last line of verse 8, 35:8.
Walking the way of the Jews will not go about.
Okay. How do you take that? And the wicked fools, the wicked, I like that. The wicked fools will not wander on it, not go about on it. But what do you take that to mean? I've heard different things. So I'm just open to your thoughts. What does he mean? This highway, which we know is a highway that leads to Zion, the mountain of God, for people to come worship. And says the wicked fool won't wander on.
Well, in Proverbs says that a fool says there is no God.
Okay. Okay.
Why would the fool wander on the way that says there is a God?
Okay.
This one says, this distinguished standard version, it says, the unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if they are fools, we shall not go astray.
Yeah, see. That's the piece I don't agree with.
Mm-hmm.
See, even if the fool says there's no God, I think what he's saying is you won't find a fool on that road.
Right.
The fools will not be on that road. What I was taught as I was being raised, well, even if you're a fool, you won't go astray if you get on that road. Well, that's not what he's saying. He's saying we're going to have this pristine path that leads to worship to God. There won't be unclean on it. There won't be there won't be fools on it, but it'll be for the people who want to walk that way. No lion will be there, nor any vicious beast go up on it. These will not be found there, but the redeemed will walk. This is a path leading into this beautiful garden that God is creating here. You see, the lushness is calling to mind a garden state. What is the Persian word for royal garden? Paradise. Paradise. That's where the word paradise comes into the Greek Bible or the Greek New Testament. It's the Persian word for the royal fenced-in garden, God's garden, that he's calling his people into. Yes?
Gentiles were called fools, so maybe their techniques could also be saying a big highway, you tend to want to just stay on it, so you don't even have to be that high in your ability to think to
no.
go.
No, you've got to think. God says, come, let us reason together. Paul reasoned with people, and that's how he led them to Christ. God intends us to reason, to think, to reason. The fact when Solomon in his Proverbs says the fool is setting aside there is no God. He wasn't talking about the pagans and the Gentiles. He's talking about Jews. He's talking about the people that he lived among. Of course, it would be true of everybody. But the fool is the person who, I guess the best way to define a fool is the one who listens, who approves and his own advice above all others. He doesn't want to take advice from anybody because his is good enough. That's the fool. He won't be on this road. You won't have to worry about him. Let's keep going. We're almost done. And the ransomed of Yahweh will return and come with joyful shouting to Zion. So we're talking about the day when the wilderness becomes a well-watered plain because the Spirit of God will have been poured out on them. We're talking about the day of Messiah. We're not talking about something down at the end of time. We're talking about something down at the end of Jewish covenant time, the last days of the covenant of Moses. Then the watering of the worries about foreign invasion and foreign discipline would all be gone. And God would have his people. Now, that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be challenges. That wouldn't doesn't mean that there wouldn't be difficulties. Doesn't mean that, okay, from now on, you don't have to stand up for your faith because I got you covered. God doesn't want a bunch of weaklings. He wants people who have to make hard decisions. He wants people who trust him to make the difficult stand and sacrifice their physical life to save their spiritual life. He wants that kind of people. I know that's the case because when he opened the fifth seal, you know, the seven sealed book, when he opened the fifth seal, he saw the souls under the altar that had, when they're under the altar, that's where the blood of the sacrifices goes under the altar. They had given up their life for their testimony. And they're saying, how long? How long until we get our reward? He says, stay here for a little while longer until your brothers who are going to die like you do. God was not saving them from physical death. He was saving them for himself. And so, their ransom will return to Yahweh. Now, Michael, those people who were addressed in James 1 and 1 Peter 1 are called the what?
Diaspora or diaspora.
The diaspora, also known as the dispersed, the scattered. He's talking about Jewish population have been scattered because of the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions. They fled to the various nations. So I'm going to gather them back. I'm going to gather them back to me when I pour out the Spirit from on high. And they will find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. Now, contextually, the sorrow and the sighing had to do with the rigors of this invasion that was coming. And then ultimately, extendedly, to the long national night, the darkness. Remember, Matthew 4, the people sitting in darkness saw a great light when Jesus started preaching, the long national night was starting to dawn. Okay, any thoughts? Next week, we're going to get into the historical account that brings this full circle, how God dealt with the Assyrians on their behalf, but what it took. Yeah, Linda?
Well, I think that highway started with John the Baptist. It talks about it when Isaiah 4 used it.
Yep.
A voice is calling, clear the way to the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God.
Yep.
And that, I think it makes him do it. A couple places.
The point that we've made before, and it is valuable and worth making again, is that the teaching in the New Testament has its roots in and is interpretive of the prophets. And so when John was the voice crying in the wilderness, he was bringing to light and interpreting what Isaiah meant in chapter 40. So again, next week we'll pick up with 36 through 39 is the historical account of the end of the Assyrian domination and the onset of the Babylonian.
And that's the reading.
Yes, 36 through 39 is the reading until we finish 39. The notes that were on chapter 34 and 35, I printed up after class last week. You may or may not have got them. If you did, they're here. Okay, well, let us just take a minute to pray together, and then we'll be dismissed. Scott, would you do that, please?